We'll move to the second case of the morning, which is Verissa McKinney versus Callaway Properties. Mr. Borsia.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This is an extraordinary case. This is a case where the plaintiff is claiming damages under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. It is a case where the plaintiff's claim is based upon an assertion that a letter was confusing. The plaintiff herself admitted in the case that she did not find the letter to be confusing. The plaintiff presented no extrinsic evidence in the case of any type of confusion, and yet the district court entered summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff in the case. There was no basis in the record to grant summary judgment to the plaintiff. The court, in fact, should have granted summary judgment to the defendant because of the plaintiff's failure to adduce evidence, extrinsic evidence of confusion.
The court looked at it from the standpoint not so much as the plaintiff. The plaintiff reacted by calling her attorney. But they looked at the last paragraph as basically discarding some of the earlier parts of it and said that that was conflicting and therefore it would be confusing to the whatever it is, a less sophisticated consumer.
That was the court's rationale. But the record showed, I agree, it's not determinative if the plaintiff found it to be confusing, but in the face of a situation where the plaintiff presents no extrinsic evidence, the plaintiff's own admission that she did not find it to be confusing surely means it's, at the very least, summary judgment should not have been entered in the case. The issue of whether confusion exists is a fact question. It's not a legal question. And there are, I acknowledge there are cases where the courts have found there is language that's clearly conflicting from what you have in the statute to what a letter says that can make it summary judgment eligible. In this case, this letter does not do that. The letter does not contradict any of the rights that she has. We're focusing now on the last paragraph of the letter, and it's in essence consistent with what the letter is asking her to do. It's giving her her validation rights.
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
You seem to argue, Callaway seems to argue, that it does not collect debts that are owed to others, but rather only attempts to collect debts that are owed to Callaway. And it seems to me that your reading of the FDCPA is a bit too narrow. When Callaway purchases a delinquent debt, it is then attempting to collect on a debt that was owed to another. If Callaway's interpretation were correct, then the FDCPA would have no teeth because no debt collector who owned the debt would be subject to any of its provisions, and the Act would apply only to third-party companies that are hired to collect the debts of others. And that would be an incredibly narrow reading of the Act, given its protective purpose, wouldn't it?
I think you're right, Your Honor. I think the issue in this case, is on that issue, is did the plaintiff present evidence in the record to meet the statute to apply to say that Callaway was a debt collector as a matter of law? There is obviously situations where if you are assigned a debt and you are in the act of, in essence, servicing a debt, that you may not be considered to be a debt collector. There is case law out there that says that, you know, in the role of an assignee, which is what happened here, simply servicing a debt does not mean you are a debt collector. And I think this is an area of the law that's not very clear in terms of under the statute of when you would fall under that penumbra. I think the plaintiff's position is you are collecting a debt, you fall under that regardless, even if you are getting it assigned at a later point in time.
In the case of, just to follow up on that, in this particular debt that was in default, who was it originally owed to?
It was owed originally to the SBA. It was a small business.
So if the SBA is going about trying to collect it itself, Is the SBA, in effect, a debt collector?
I think not. Not, Your Honor.
No, I understand what you're trying to assert is that you are now the owner of this debt, and you're trying to collect that debt on, I mean you, meaning Cataway, on your own behalf, as opposed to on behalf of someone else.
Correct.
And that, does that shift you into the creditor category?
I think,
or something other than a debt collector?
I think it's not entirely clear under the statute or the case law. I think this is sort of a novel issue. I do think that the statute focuses on debts being collected for other people. That's my belief. But I think in this case, that issue is not the main issue. The main issue is was there a violation of the statute as a matter of law based upon the evidence in the record here?
And tell me this. Is it Cataway's position that some of the almost 3,500 form letters that are at issue here were sent to collect business debts?
I think the issue there is the plaintiff did not submit evidence that those letters were used to collect consumer debts. And really, those other letters are not at issue in the case.
I'd be grateful, though, if you would there's obviously a reason for my question. were some of them sent to collect business debts?
I believe they were, Your Honor.
They were?
Yes.
Well, each of these letters begins with the sentence, in accordance with 15 U.S.C. 1692E, 11 in paren, and this section is part of the Consumer Credit Protection Act and would be applicable to the collection of a business debt, wouldn't it?
Correct. You're right, Your Honor. Yes.
So isn't that somewhat of a problem here?
Well, the issue on the other letters, it's not at issue. The issue is this letter to this plaintiff, was it confusing as a matter of law? That's the main issue in the case, I believe. And the issue we get to is, what did the plaintiff do in the trial court to establish the right to summary judgment in her favor? We have the Durkin case. Many other cases talk about to prove confusion, you have to come up with extrinsic evidence, and they analogize it to trademark law, where you can have a survey or an expert. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. You finish your thought.
And in this case, none of that was done. All the plaintiff did is said, here's a letter, and the very plaintiff herself says, I don't find it confusing.
But tell me this. What would have happened if Reverend McKinney had sent back the verification form stating that she owed $1,000 rather than the $4,032, plus interest and charges? Would this have been a sufficient dispute to trigger Cataway's obligation to verify the debt and mail a copy of that verification to McKinney?
Absolutely. And that's why we believe the form at the end is consistent with what this letter is doing. It is asking her, is she contesting the debt pursuant to what the statute is saying? It's not inconsistent. There's nothing confusing about it. She didn't find it confusing. She didn't fill out the form. She went to her lawyer, and he filed this case. But the issue is, did this form, and there's no case law that supports that this type of language would be confusing as a matter of law.
But some of this has to be based on logic and on cases, that both the parties cited. And surely it's legitimate for a district court to determine whether the language of a particular letter is confusing on its face. I have to tell you, I still don't understand if she could have properly disputed the debt by mailing back the verification form saying that she owed $1,000.
Well, I think the case law, Your Honor, is it's not based upon logic. It is a fact-based. It's not based upon logic, a judge sitting back reading this saying, what do I think about this? It's based upon fact issues.
Well, and you have to show significant... if a person who's intelligent enough, pray God, to become, a district judge says, wait a minute, this is really confusing to me, that
It's not the standard. The standard is it confusing to a significant portion of the population who would get the letter? That's the standard. And that's why the case is talking about using surveys, experts, to establish that. And it's the rare case where you can say, as a matter of law, especially here where the plaintiff herself is saying, I didn't find it confusing. The letter listed rights that she had. The last paragraph doesn't take away any of those rights. There's nothing in the letter that says she had to do anything within 30 days. The 30 days is pronounced throughout the letter. There is nothing in this letter that contradicts or is confusing, and especially as a matter of law. And the cases in the circuit talk about this is not a matter of logic. This is a matter of a fact issue based upon what a significant part of the population. And it's not as if...
So you don't think that it's an issue at all as to whether she presented sufficient evidence that Cattleway regularly attempted to collect consumer as opposed to business debts?
That is an issue because she has the burden of proof on every issue. And she had the burden to prove that Cattleway was a debt collector in this case, and it's our position that they did not prove that. But another issue, she had the burden to prove, unlike us, we don't have the burden of proof, she had the burden to prove, as a matter of law, that this letter was confusing, and there's nothing in the record to support that, and there's no case law to support that.
You know, I still have to go back to this other issue here, because when we look at... We're supposed to look at this, and the judge was to look at it in the shoes of an unsophisticated consumer, whatever that's worth. But it's for if it's confusing enough, where somebody would look at that last paragraph and say, "Well, I got to do that now. I can't wait 30 days." You say, "Well, that they shouldn't have assumed that." I could say, "Well, they probably shouldn't have," and even need to answer. But go back to what Judge Rovner asked. She said, "Yeah, I owe $1,000, and that's it." From what I understand about a lot of this stuff, when debts are not collectible, they package them up, and some people will pay for those and buy them for whatever they're worth and try to collect them. But they're their debts, and that's where I was focusing on this originally. Is there a situation where the complexion of this obligation has changed from a consumer debt to what's basically a discarded asset? It's sort of like a something that's in a used car lot. It's less than originally it was worth. And I don't. And it seems to me if it's Cattleway's to either collect or throw away, they're not. It's theirs. They bought it for cheap and hope they can get something back on it. And she said it's worth $1,000. They may say, "Well, we'll take that because we only paid $500 for this." I'm going hypothetically because I don't quite understand Cattleway's position, but it seems to me it's something like that, and it has to be, you're trying to recharacterize it so that you're not a debt collector, that this is something that you own. Now, maybe that's not where you're going.
One of the things you said I want to just... Because there's nothing in this letter that says she has to do anything within 30 days. And she didn't have to, and it doesn't say you have to fill out the form. It gives her her rights. But I think the issue of how the obligation came to Cattleway is not really relevant in terms of the issue of whether the letter is confusing or not, or what they're trying to do here.
Whether or not you're a debt collector, because you made a lot of...
That, I think, is relevant to that issue.
But we've got conflicting findings of fact from the two district judges on that issue, don't we?
Yes, we do.
There was a finding initially that at the time your client acquired this loan, it was not in default, and then when Judge Kendall took over the case, she came to the opposite finding. I'm not sure how to reconcile that.
Well, I think it just points out there are fact issues that have to be, that should have gone at the very least to trial, if you get to that issue. It's our position, though, that before you get to that issue, the plaintiff had to present evidence of confusion, either extrinsic evidence, either through a survey or through an expert. And when you have the plaintiff herself saying, "I'm not confused," you know, it's unimaginable. You could say, "Well, I'm still going to grant summary judgment to the plaintiff saying that I'm confused." And I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. Unless there's any other questions.
Well, I was just thinking sometimes people are so confused they don't know they're confused.
Well, I mean, if you were to file
That's how I feel right now.
If you were to file a lawsuit and saying the basis of my lawsuit is this letter confused me, and yet in discovery you admit you're not confused, that's a problem.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Greg?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Randolph Bragg. With me today, seated at council table, is my co-counsel, Craig Shapiro. Defendants, in their briefing, first present the argument that they are not a debt collector. That's incorrect. They admit that they collect debts in their answer to the complaint. They admit that they obtained Ms. McKinney's debt after it had fallen into default. The record supports that. And they admit that they sent out 3,448 letters in the form of the letter they sent to Reverend McKinney. Therefore, they regularly collect debts. And as the court below found, they fit the definition of debt collector.
Does it matter who owns the debt? If it does, if a lender lends money and the borrower doesn't pay and the lender tries to collect, are they a debt collector?
No, they are a creditor.
Because they own the debt, basically.
And I'm wondering if they originated the debt.
Originated, okay. So that's, you would distinguish it that way, because the originator has to try to collect that debt in order to not be a debt collector.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because if this debt was, you know, I don't know how he got it, how Cataway got it, but I assume these are bad debts that are not collectible by somebody, and they sell them for a lot big discount, and if somebody else thinks they can collect it, good for them, and they pay a discount on them, I think. I'm guessing. So once that happens, if the person who then now owns that debt cannot be something other than a debt collector.
That is correct, and this court held so in the Schlosser decision.
Well, it held different things in the Schlosser decision, said things about other things in the Schlosser decision, and I'm not sure that was actually a holding, but in any event, there was some reference that if it's in default, and then it's something else, I guess. I don't know.
Yes, Your Honor.
Didn't say very much. He said that. Anyway, that's what I'm trying to explore, because that's the curiosity I have in this particular case, and it may be different than what everybody else is looking at. But that's what attracted my attention.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the Small Business Association sold the debt to Aurora. Aurora then sold the debt to Cataway, and Cataway sent its collection letter. So it's third in line, as a matter of fact.
Who's going to get the money if the debtor pays?
It's my understanding that Cataway will.
It's theirs to keep if they get it.
Yes.
They're not collecting it for someone else and going to pay them some or all of it.
That is my understanding, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You know, I have a different... Let me take you on a little different road for a minute. Cataway claims it was not granted an opportunity to respond to your motion to alter or amend the judgment, and that the district court granted the motion 9 days after it was filed without a briefing schedule. How would you respond to that?
Well, Cataway could have requested that the court receive its brief and to be allowed time to do so. They could have filed a motion pursuant to Rule 59E or Rule 60 for that permission. However, our view is that the damages, statutory damages issue, arises from the cross motions for summary judgment. At no time in the briefing on summary judgment did Cataway raise its opposition to the court making the determination of whether to award statutory damages and in what amount.
Well, I take it that you do a lot of this sort of work, both of you. So what kind of evidence of damages in today's world do district court judges usually require before granting statutory damages in these cases? I was racking my brains back to my district court days, but that was a century ago.
The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act at 15 U.S.C. Section 1692K, one of the subsections, provides a list of four or five criteria. Frequency and persistence is one. I think willful violation is another. But there's a list of factors that the court may consider in determining the amount of statutory damages. As Your Honor is aware, it's up to $1,000.
Right. Okay, thank you.
I believe nature of the violation is another factor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now moving to the second argument of appellants, that the letter did not violate the act. It is clear on the face of the letter that it contradicted and overshadowed the validation notice that's required by the FDCPA. The front page of the collection letter, in bold print and underlined, directs the consumer to complete and return the notice of validation of debt. Then on the opposite side of the collection letter is the validation of debt notice. It provides the required notice in the first four or five paragraphs, and then it adds a paragraph that is not required by the Act. It directs the consumer to confirm the amount of the debt. That contradicts what the statute says. The statute, in fact, requires the debt collector to verify the debt upon the consumer's written request.
Were it not for that last paragraph, we wouldn't be here. Is that fair to say?
That is correct. There would not have been a lawsuit. We would not have been here. And that violation is clear on its face. Therefore, no extrinsic evidence is required. The district court, as it did, can just look at it and determine whether it is violative of the act or not.
So, in other words, it wouldn't matter if the Reverend McKinney in her deposition said, I understood.
That is correct, Your Honor. It is based upon whether the unsophisticated consumer would perceive the collection letter to be contradictory or confusing.
I guess we have to assume someone calls their lawyer right away. They're sophisticated, huh?
Well, I don't think that it's not in the record, so I won't address it.
No, I'm just kidding. I mean, because that's how we usually get these cases. You know, somebody gets a hold of it and say, aha, you know, here we go. We got an error in it. And so we see a lot of these cases, as you know.
And, yes, Your Honor,
and the people who call their lawyer right away are usually a little more on the ball than we'll call them the unsophisticated consumer. But nevertheless, that's the, I guess, the objective test we have to follow.
If she's not in the group of unsophisticated consumers who might have been confused by this, because she's testified that she wasn't confused, how can she bring this claim? What sort of an injury does she have?
Again, the standard is whether the unsophisticated consumer...
I know what the standard is, counsel. I asked a different sort of a question.
Yeah, and her claim is that the letter contradicts the Fair Debt Collection Practices
Act. But she herself
Act.
Is not in that group of unsophisticated consumers who might have been confused, because she's testified that she wasn't confused. So what sort of an injury has she suffered if this was not confusing to her? What right does she have to bring this claim?
As a consumer, she has the right to enforce the Fair Debt Collection
Practices.
A consumer
practice. Who was not confused, as a factual matter.
Even if she was not confused, yes, she can bring this act, this lawsuit.
What sort of an injury has she suffered?
no actual damages. She has suffered statutory damages, which may be up to $1,000.
Not being confused.
For the defendants misinforming her of her rights under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, yes.
By that misinformation, she was not confused, so she still gets a right to recover the statutory damages.
Yes,
do you
sure.
see the disconnect that I'm trying to illustrate here?
Yes,
does that
sure.
make any sense?
Yes, and it is.
How would we explain that to the normal person on the street as being a sensible result, a sensible interpretation of this claim?
That debt collectors are not allowed to mislead or contradict anyone, whether you are sophisticated or unsophisticated.
And that someone who was not, in fact, misled has the right to recover the statutory damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that, I take it, is in order to protect the rest of us idiots.
Yes, to protect consumers in general.
No, there's in addition to that, is there attorney fees and things come into that? Attorney's fees and costs?
Yes, the successful consumer may recover costs and attorney's fees.
That could even possibly exceed $1,000, couldn't it?
I'm sorry, I didn't
That could exceed $1,000, I presume, couldn't it? Attorney's fees and costs?
As awarded by the district court pursuant to the Lodestar formula.
Mm-hmm. So you've come a long way, so I assume the attorney's fees will greatly exceed whatever statutory damages are.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Statutory damages were just, I'm sorry, costs and attorney's fees were just awarded by the district court in the amount of $40,000 or so.
So you've brought forth a noble cause, at least, on behalf of the unsophisticated consumer.
Yes, Your Honor, the courts have interpreted this to be enforced by private attorney generals, and to encourage them to do so, they authorize the payment of their costs and attorney's fees if they are successful. If they are unsuccessful, they bear their own burden.
Okay. Do you have anything else?
No, Your Honor, unless there are further questions.
We gave the other one a minute. We'll give you another minute if you got something to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I thought I reserved 5
minutes. You did, but you see, what happens is
right.
You use it.
Okay, I'll
hurry up.
In terms of Your Honor's question, the Cobbs case says that damages are a jury question, generally, and it's our position we weren't given the opportunity, given the timing, to address that. Counsel says this letter was...
Are you saying that statutory damages are a jury question?
Yes, Cobb's case talks about that, Your Honor. Yes. The issue of confusion. Counsel argues that this language was contradictory and overshadowed. That's his argument. There's no evidence of that. And what he's pointing to is the paragraph that doesn't say she was required to fill this out. In fact, she didn't fill this out. And Kate Away didn't take away any of her rights. This is a situation where he's making arguments without evidence. And the case law, the Durkin case, other cases say, you are supposed to come up with evidence of that. And here, there's nothing that contradicts what was said in the letter. Basically, all it's saying is, tell us the amount you believe is owed. If she says it's less than the amount they believe it's owed, that's the same thing as her saying she's contesting the debt. This paragraph is entirely consistent with the rest of the letter. And to say this somehow as a matter of law, without any evidence extrinsically, and without the plaintiff herself even saying she was confused. And the standard, it's not the least sophisticated consumer. The standard, this court has said, it's unsophisticated consumers who are given certain attributes, one of which is they're supposed to read collection letters carefully. The plaintiff in this case apparently did that. And when she read it carefully, she decided she was not confused.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks very much. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.